Welcome, everyone, to the Screamcast episode 47. I'm Sean DeRager.
And as always, Brad Henderson.
And Brad's here. Yes.
Well, you always like say shit whenever I go, hey.
We are taking it, we're diverging a bit from horror. We are talking blaxploitation. And Brad, you brought this up. And when I first heard it, I was like, well, wait a minute. We're more of a kind of.
Basically, Sean said no.
I was on the fence about it. I don't know, because, you know, we're trying to be more of a horror podcast. But then we have Blackula and Scream, Blackula Scream coming out in March from Scream Factory. So, you know, this is kind of the perfect, perfect spot to kind of lay the foundation of blaxploitation, because I think there's more to Blackula and Scream, Blackula Scream than just, you know, a black version of Dracula. So
Brad, also it's Black History Month.
Also, yes. I was just getting to that. Also, it is Black History Month. So we figured, Brad figured, this is all Brad's idea.
So basically, if it fails, fuck you, Brad.
Yes. No, I think it's cool, and I think it's a good idea. So we'll be diving into some blaxploitation. I wanted to. Normally around this time we do the Blu-ray announcements.
Do you like what you see?
I love what I see.
Would you like to touch what you see?
Yes. Yes, I would.
Yeah, I mean, there hasn't been much. I mean, I know that they, Needful Things got announced mm-hmm. in Stigmata, but, I mean, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
As far as, there's a couple others, but, you know, not too much to dive into.
Yeah.
You know, we're trying to keep an eye on, of course, now Kino is the ones that are announcing like titles like every single day, it seems. And Scream has kind of backed off.
It sounds like from what I heard in my kind of offhand conversations with them, it sounded like they're holding off it. They're done announcing for a while, and then probably going to give it a couple months. Because I was giving them shit. I was giving them shit because Kino was announcing.
Oh, really? You give them shit?
It was a playful. You know, it was being playful because I was like, well, it looks like, you know, Kino is going to be getting a lot more of my money this year than Scream Factory. So I sent on Twitter, and of course they responded. You know, well, we haven't announced everything yet. Wait till, you know, we got a lot in store for later on this year. Blah blah blah. So, you know, we'll see, because they're going to do their Summer of Fear Part 2 and things like that. So, you know,
we'll see.
We'll see what happens. But right now, Kino's winning. And 88 Films, with their announcement that they're going to be doing the American Ninja series, a box set.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
That's awesome.
And as far as stuff being released today, Rabbit and Toy Soldiers has been released over in the UK.
Yep,
Rabbit on Arrow and Toy Soldiers on, I think, called 101 Films. I don't know exactly what that is, but I guess they're dealing with, like, cult favorites.
I hope it's good.
And today, The Amazing Starry Eyes is out. The ridiculous ABCs of Death 2 has hit. And highly recommended kind of do-it-yourself reminiscing of old school shot on video stuff, Demon's Rook. Highly suggest picking that one out, especially if you like special effects and goofy shit. The Amazing, kind of just huge surprise, I saw it at Fantastic Fest, was John Wick. Just unbelievable. Such a great little action film, and will probably become one of these huge cult favorites. Everything about this movie is just fucking cool. Like, it's got a killer soundtrack. It's got some of the best action sequences you'll ever see in a movie. It has a goofy plot, but it fucking works. I highly recommend it. And Keanu is just, he's like all over the place these days, and he just fucking nails this John Wick role. And I'm hoping with the, because actually the movie was a minor success at the box office, which was kind of surprising. And I'm hoping that this gets kind of a small little franchise. So we'll see. And then Call the Conqueror with Kevin Sorbo is out on Blu-ray, and so is Ouija. So that one kind of fizzled out quickly at the box office, but that is a PG-13 horror film. So
what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who knows? I haven't seen it yet. I mean, I want to. So we'll see. But that's it.
Cool. I did want to bring up real quick that at the time we're recording this, Severin Films put something out on their Facebook saying that they are going to be basically they're done distributing the Blu-ray of the Manson Family, and they're going to be destroying whatever stock that they have and whatever stores have. They're selling out. I'm going to read this thing to you, and we will comment. So it says, as some of you may have seen, the director of one of our titles is engaging in a spot of slander. We'll be embarking on a legal battle with regards to this behavior, which we can assume will not be resolved quickly. We got involved in quite an uphill battle by committing to the near impossible task of finishing the movie The Manson Family back in the early 2000s. But we were green with an inexperience, and don't get us wrong, we are very proud of helping to get it to the finish line where others were unable to, and ultimately of the film itself. Even though it cost about six times what was proposed to us, it took about five times as long. Unfortunately, its recent 10th anniversary Blu-ray reissue turned out to be a big commercial failure. As a result, we have no choice but to withdraw the title from distribution in all territories for an indefinite time until the matter is appropriately resolved. Effective Monday, yesterday, the Manson Family will be taken down from the Severin store. No more copies will be produced, and current inventory will be destroyed. Therefore, causing some sort of black market, and you'll be able to find this movie for about $70 on eBay.
Yeah. So basically, that means that Jim Van Bever ran his mouth again, probably to Don May. Don May got pissed off because Jim Van Bever says he's not getting – this is from Jim Van Bever personally. I've heard this from him personally, is that he is not getting paid. Mm. Well, if the film is a commercial failure on Blu-ray, you're not getting any, probably any residual checks because it's not selling.
Right.
And he – there's actually we can probably link it in the show if I can find it, is that he called Don May a few years ago about the transfer for Deadbeat at Dawn. And Don May actually put the voicemails – there's like five voicemails online, and you can still listen to them, and it's just Drunk Jim just fucking going off about the transfer and about how shitty they were and all that stuff. And you know, I imagine it's all stemming from that. They're probably going to hit him for slander because he talks, you know. I feel bad for the guy, you know. I mean, Jim Van Bever actually lives in Florida, and you know, I've met him a couple times, and you know, he's pretty good friends with some of my friends, and he's an alcoholic, you know. And I feel bad because, you know, he's a good guy at heart, but he's just a mess.
Yeah,
I know. So how it is. I just feel bad because, you know, Severin's taken this I made a mistake. It wasn't Severin. It was Synapse with Don May.
Right.
And then Severin. I'm sorry.
Just about to ask you to clarify because.
Yeah. The Synapse of Deadbeat at Dawn, and then, you know, this is going on with Severin. So he's kind of has. I basically meant he has bad beef with a lot of distribution companies because he's not happy with anything that people are putting out. And I just think they're kind of tired of it. I mean, he's known in the film community as being an alcoholic and kind of, you know, extremely aggressive. So I think kind of, you know, those just distribution companies see it and they're just like, we want to step back and, you know, not deal with this. So,
right. And
whatever.
And
I mean, I'm hoping that it just kind of like fizzles out and he like apologizes and, you know, there's no legal action taken, but who knows?
I've heard the film's actually pretty good. I've never seen it. I bought it just because
Manson Family?
Yeah, I bought it because I was like, I missed a chance to buy it for $5 during that Hamilton book sale. And it was like $13. I was like, well, I guess it's the last chance I can friggin' buy this thing. So I bought it. I don't know if it's any good or not.
It's not.
So
I mean, it's an accomplishment. Jim Van Bever's a very, very good filmmaker. He knows what he's doing. It's just that he doesn't have the money to really like do something very huge or big. He works with what he has. Yeah. And I mean, just watching Deadbeat at Dawn, it's definitely one of the best, you know, kind of, again, even though we mentioned Demon's Rook, like a do it yourself, like shot on video. I mean, I think he shot it on 16, but you know, it's just a crazy thing to see, because, you know, he edits, he acts, he writes, he directs, and he just does what he can. And Deadbeat at Dawn's actually really good. Huh. Manson Family is okay. You know, I actually got to see it in the theater last year, here in Florida. They actually had a screening of his short film that he was trying to complete called Gator Green, that he was trying to turn into a feature, and they played that. Huh. And then they played the Manson Family. And fun story, Jim Van Bever actually got kicked out of his own screening because he was drunk.
Nice.
And we took him to the bar, and we sat with him, and had drinks. Oh,
you told me about that, dude.
Yeah, we had drinks with my buddy Brian, who's on the show during the he's the Andrew Davis expert.
Uh-huh.
We had drinks, and we sat and listened to Drunk Jim tell stories.
Oh, shit.
About filmmaking, about how he gets fucked over all the time, and it was actually one of the greatest nights ever. It was just it's kind of sucks because, I mean, he's an alcoholic.
Yeah,
but it was like we literally had drinks with Jim Van Bever and hung out with him. Just like the producer was there and a couple of the actors and his wife. Like it was like a very intimate bar setting. Yeah. With Jim Van Bever for a couple hours.
Nice.
Until they hauled him off, and then we went to the screening, and he wasn't there because he wasn't allowed back in the theater. So
that's awesome. Speaking of, before we start with the rest of the show here, speaking of Severin, their DVD Video Nasties, the Definitive Guide Part 2, comes out on the 10th. And I actually reviewed it for the site over at thescreamcast.com. And
shameless plug.
It is. Well, it's our own site, dude. I could plug it. But anyway, I wanted to say, like, if you saw part one and were kind of like shrugging, like, oh, that's it, you know, it's an okay documentary, but it's not the greatest when it comes to information about Video Nasties. This part two takes it up to like the next level on what happens once the list is made, once these things, films are banned, and then it goes into the enforcement of banning these movies and everything, and it's super good. Like it held my attention all the way through, and
super.
It's worth it. Like if you like the first one or whatever, I would definitely, even if you didn't, were kind of not very keen on the first one, like I would definitely check this out because it's a lot better. But
this is kind of like how probably these episodes for this next month of podcasting is gonna go.
No. I don't think so.
You failed to mention that we're just not doing one
episode
of Blaxploitation.
We are going to go through the month of February talking Blaxploitation.
So if you like Blaxploitation, you're in for a treat. If you don't,
sorry.
Shame on you and sorry.
Let's take a dive into Blaxploitation right now.
Now that's what I need.
What happened to my $100, Joe? Nigga, did you take my money?
Half-ass super niggas like that pair you sent after me, you only get to make that mistake one time, you dig?
Dance, motherfucker, dance! Dance!
Death is too easy for you, bitch. I want you to suffer.
Dolomite, motherfucker, you heard her.
You don't get me my money tonight, I'm gonna put that young girl of yours out on horse road.
Girl, you some kind of lucky. Just so happens I am the best damn airplane driver there is in these parts.
You're gonna work for me until I tell you to quit.
You don't own me, pig, and no motherfucker tells me when I can split.
Who the fuck do you think you're talking to?
I'm talking to you, you redneck faggot.
Man, move over and let me pass. Before they have to be pulling these hush puppies out your motherfucking ass.
So, blaxploitation. So let's lay the groundwork here, Brad. Like, you more than myself are into, like, more like 1970s, you know, decade of film. Like, for me, I more kind of jump in around the 80s is my kind of bread and butter of the kind of older flicks that I like. What kind of got you started with that decade? What is it about that decade that kind of, you know,
moves you? I mean, I grew up watching mainly the stuff from the 80s, and when I got to the age of, you know, like maybe 10 or 11, I started collecting VHS tapes, and a lot of the cheaper things were, you know, kind of reissues of stuff from the 70s. I would pick up, you know, like at the dollar store or something like that, or Big Lots. They had tapes for a buck. And I went to movie, you know, video stores and buying VHS tapes. And I don't know, there's just a lot of it from the 70s, and I just kind of got into it. And, you know, it was kind of always there. I wouldn't say like I just dove into it. I was like, the 70s.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was watching things and not really realizing at the time they were from the 70s. It was just, you know, it was just there. And then eventually when I became older, it was like the 70s always kind of turned me on because of mainly because of the music. The music's always a big factor in the 70s because, mm-hmm. you know, in the 80s we went to synth scores. Like in the 70s we actually had real artists do soundtracks for a lot of movies. And I think that's a big part of it too. The music was always better. You know, people were actually like really, really trying, it seemed. Like the 80s was just like kind of – like I – 80s is awesome, don't get me wrong, but it just seems like people tried harder in the 70s.
Yeah, well, in the 80s, I think we got into more kind of fast-tracking films and kind of just getting stuff out there with VHS and stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, landmark films in the 70s, and the 80s was just kind of like a pile of, like, a lot of trash, good trash, but, you know, just so many spitting off movies left and right, you know, every Tuesday, you know, 500 movies comes out on Tuesday. And, you know, in the 70s, it was a little bit more spread out. And, you know, there's a lot of filmmakers that even still to this day made a lot of landmarks in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So I think it's 70s that by far I consider one of the most important decades in film.
Hmm.
So, and plus it also contains blaxploitation.
It does. It does. So. For me, like this was like a subgenre that I always respected and I think I liked. A lot of, I guess, newer movies that could be considered maybe modern blaxploitation. But when it came to like in the 70s and things like that, I had a friend who was way into blaxploitation back when I was in high school. And he was way into 70s stuff. And I never got it. And he showed me Shaft, and Shaft was okay. It was kind of a good time to watch. But, I never got into anything else like Cleopatra Jones or Coffee or anything else. And I guess until later, and I haven't even seen all those movies, but I've always had a respect for blaxploitation, but I guess I never sought it out or sat down to actually watch a bunch of these films. The most information I got was about blaxploitation was when I saw Mario Van Peebles' movie Badass, where he basically documents his dad's behind the scenes of how his dad made Sweetback's Badass Song. But and then I watched, of course, the documentary on that, but that's I think as deep as I went into blaxploitation. And I like I said, I have a huge respect for the genre, but I guess I never, I don't know, it's weird
you're
that
you're gonna have a bigger respect after you're done.
I think so. And that's the thing, like I tweeted out a month ago, I was like, man, there needs to be more blaxploitation on, you know, on Blu-ray, because I was watching Foxy Brown, and I was like, and it looked fantastic. And I was like, man, we got to get more of these movies on, you know,
they'll
on
come. Blu-ray. MGM but, owns them all, so and all MGM right. licensed out everything. So I'm hoping because they're like the people that did, you know, all the Soul Cinema DVDs, like the double packs that came out a few years ago. So cool. If MGM owns them, I'm pretty sure that Kino is going to go in there and probably snatch them up, which will be nice.
Yeah, that'd be good. I mean, the thing that I like about these movies is there's a don't give a fuck attitude on a lot of these. And there is almost like there's like no rules. They could do whatever they want almost, and you get that feeling. But I wanted to let you kind of lay the groundwork here for the beginnings of blaxploitation. How did you kind of start getting involved with it, you know, yourself, you know, interested in it, and then
Like I knew it existed. I saw Shaft without knowing exactly what blaxploitation was when I was younger. I like caught it on USA or something like that. It wasn't until I was probably like honestly like my early 20s, I was at a place called Specs. I don't know if that was a big chain. It turned into FYE. FYE bought Specs, and you know, now everybody knows that. Now that's kind of dead too. But I was just like going through some of their stock, and I come across Superfly, and it was like super cheap. Super cheap. But anyways, I was like, oh man, you know, they had like the soundtrack with it, and I was like, okay. I was like, you know, I'm going to try to do something different, you know, because I'd always pick up weird things or obscure things. And so I gave that a shot, and I watched that night. And I fell in love with the movie and, of course, the soundtrack. And then I just started diving into other things because, you know, I was a big fan of From Dusk Till Dawn, and Fred Williamson is in that. And so then, you know, because I knew that he used a bunch of people, and, of course, you know, with Jackie Brown and Pulp Fiction, there's a lot of films that take those kind of elements, and Tarantino throws it in his and in other films. And then I just kind of started diving into it, and I had Netflix, like, you know, at home, where they would send the discs, if anybody does that anymore. You know, I would just try to grab everything I can, and I just kind of fell in love with it then and there. Over like a year, I tried to watch just about everything, because there was just something that, you know, drew me to it. Number one is, you're kind of right. Like, it's kind of like no rules. They wanted to make an impact, so they did what they wanted. And I kind of like that. And then when I started actually like reading about it and learning the history behind it and kind of what they've done and what they did, I was like, holy shit, this is actually like, this is a movement.
Yeah,
it's not just a genre. It was a movement, and it's more of a movement than a genre anyway. It was something that really is one of the biggest impacts in the history of cinema. And people say, you know, and there's a common misconception that all blaxploitation is still around. Well, it's not, because it served its purpose. They put it out there. It served its purpose. They went with it. It worked. Mm-hmm. Now we still have it. It's just not blaxploitation anymore. And also, they kind of got out of that, you know, because it was a lot of anger fuel. It was fueled anger and, you know, things like that, because we're coming right out of the civil rights stuff, you know, in the 70s, when, you know, Cotton Comes to Harlem and Sweet Sweetback was released. Like, there wasn't, you know, black people walking around having a great time. You know, they would get on a corner and then they would be arrested or beaten still. So whenever we had movies that had these people as the heroes, we had, you know, black people, the heroes, and they were beating up the cops, and the cops were corrupt. You know, that was only something they could do in the movies. You couldn't do that. I mean, you could do it in real life, but you get arrested or shot.
Right.
But, you know, it was something like we could almost get away with it. So, you know, it gave them a voice in a way that was kind of, you know, really hard to be heard. You know, because when fucking Martin Luther King and Malcolm X were gone. So, you know, they did it through cinema. And I think it's a huge achievement.
Yeah.
So any words, Sean?
No, I mean, I'm just going to, we're just going to continue on here. Cause I think, cause I tried going in and seeing like, all right, what, what black oriented movies were there before, you know, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. And I found a movie called Buffalo Soldier, and I think that was from 1970. And it was about a colored regiment, black regiment. I'm gonna get these terms all wrong. So I mean, I don't mean to offend, but a black regiment in the Civil War, and they're called the Buffalo Soldiers. It's based on history, but the movie was kind of a joke. Like, it was obviously low budget, but it was like they were trying to juggle the white actors and the black actors, and the black actors were more kind of caricatures and almost there for a laugh a little bit. I don't know. It was kind of a weird movie to watch, because it's something based on something that could have been empowering to, you know, the black culture back then, because this was a group of soldiers that actually did something back in the Civil War. But it wasn't treated with the levity that it should have been treated. And they never were.
That's something I would like, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because that actually brings in a huge thing, because, you know, you always hear people say, blaxploitation is a term that's in a genre that's thrown around a lot.
Yeah.
Even though people don't know what it means, oh, black people were in that movie in the, 1960, it's a blaxploitation movie. Well, no. There were black people in movies,
right?
But there was two things that they were always basically done, is that either that they played a slave or a comedic role,
yeah,
or they were a high class black person trying to be accepted by the white community. You know, I mean, we have, look who's coming to dinner, or guess who's coming to dinner with Sidney Poitier, yeah, where he's trying to like impress by basically being white. You know, like they actually had to have, you know, like the approval from white people or, you know, anything like that. Blaxploitation came in and was like, no, fuck the man. Fuck white people. They're bad. We're going to kill them. You know, and it'd be the fucking Sweetback's Badass Song is about a fucking guy who basically saves, a Black Panther from corrupt cops.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's vigilante justice, you know, and he becomes like a revolutionary. And yeah, you know, that's a huge step, because that's just like, you know, Whitey's the man, Whitey is the bad guy. And, you know, they just turn the tables. That's exactly what they did, because we're so used to, oh, the villain, oh, that's going to be the black guy because, you know, he steals shit. You know, but no, they totally switched it around, and then that's exactly where, blaxploitation made its impact. Yeah. So yeah, anything before Sweetback, that's a tongue twister. But anyways, Sweetback, anything before that, like no, it's not like that is the founding father of blaxploitation.
Yeah,
you know, and I know another film, and something I told you to watch was Cotton Comes to Harlem.
Yes.
Which is a great film, written and directed by Ossie Davis, who, you know, is extremely well known, who plays the dad in Badass, by the way.
Yeah.
But anyways, like that movie alone was huge at the time, like during its release. And you had, you know, fucking Coffin Head and Gravedigger, two badass fucking cops, mm-hmm, detectives in Harlem that are, you know, just kind of relentless. You know, of course, you know, Gravedigger is just is a little bit more on the lighter side, and Coffin Head is kind of, you know, just, you know, doesn't really give a fuck and just beats the shit out of people. But even that movie, there's just a lot of comedy. I mean,
it's a very weird humor.
Not Cotton's not a person, it's fucking Cotton.
Right.
You know, there's a cotton bale of cotton that is in Harlem that they're trying to find. Well, okay, that's great, but we're also taking that and kind of making it comical. Like, and the movie is partially a comedy.
Yeah, I would look at it as it's an action comedy for sure.
Yeah, and you know, we also have Reverend O'Malley, who has like that Southern church kind of thing going for him, but he's also the white guy, it seems like. He's like, and that's the thing, and even Gravedigger Jones, he's kind of like a white, like he does not, the only blaxploitation aspect of that movie is Coffin Ed, you know, because he's just relentless. He just doesn't care. And also, you know, the Reverend's trying to get all the, you know, all the black people back to Africa. You know, and that's just another thing. Like, Cotton's involved, and it's almost like a it's just a comedy, it seems.
Yeah.
Even though it is important, and it actually is a good movie, and it's funny, and there's some actually pretty good small little action sequences in it.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I don't really consider it true blaxploitation. I think Cotton Comes to Harlem gave like kind of a running gun of like, you know, because it was actually a very successful movie.
Yeah.
You know, that was in probably in the back of Melvin Van Peebles' mind. It's like, okay, well, let me take, you know, this is successful. Let me take this to the next level. Well, because, yeah. I mean, go ahead, Sean.
Well,
I was like,
well, Melvin Van Peebles did Watermelon Man the same year. Out the same year.
Yeah.
And, like, just reading that synopsis is like, good God. Like, Watermelon Man was an extremely bigoted white man. Finds out hard and somewhat humorous way what it's like being a black man firsthand. So it's about a white man that turns black.
Yeah, it's yeah.
And you read that, and movie, you're like, oh shit.
No, I hate that movie. I really do. I hate it. I just don't. It's just not.
But like, that did well. Know. But that did well for Melvin Van Peebles, and that's and they wanted more movies from him, and that's what gave him the inspiration.
But they wanted more comedies. Right. They wanted more. Let's laugh at black people because black people are funny.
Yeah.
You know. But you know, I kind of like that reverse where he's just like, you know, he's like thinking about it. He's like, no. No, because this is not what I want to do. Like, yeah. That he might have loved that film. That was fun for him. But I don't know. Like, getting laughed at and all the stuff that was going on at that time, you know, this is extremely important. Like, this really pushed forward. I mean, not only did it do something for cinema, it did something for black people in their, like, lives. It a lot of people don't even know that. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, there were a bunch of black people that didn't watch these movies, but things were changing, you know, especially now that Hollywood saw this, like, kind of niche for it. They were like, oh, okay, black people, let's put those in movies because that's what's popular. And I mean, Hollywood kind of, you know, they took a swing with it. I mean, yeah. They actually did make some really good blaxploitation movies. But I mean, Sweetback was, you know, kind of guerrilla style filmmaking. You know, he was getting this done within no time. You know, he shot the movie with over like a 3 week period.
Yeah.
And from, you know, alone from, well, I guess we got to mention Bill Cosby. You know, he's in the limelight, but I mean, he did something nice this time, whatever. But anyways, you know, he got the movie from, or got the money from Bill Cosby, and he, you know, made this, you know, this blaxploitation movie that's nitty and gritty, and
it's a strange movie too.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's kind of weird because, you know, you can totally tell the problems, and obviously there's problems on set because, I mean, the editing's fucked up, yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's not a well put together movie, but it really, really hit, you know, and it's just, it was a profitable film, even though they didn't think it was going to be. And it kickstarted this huge, huge thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about Sweetback is, like, I feel like the big, it opens with, basically, a boy who's like 8 years old, like having sex for the first time with a hooker, a prostitute, or whatever, and in this whorehouse, or whatever. And it's like it's almost like he's daring everyone to stay in their seats, you know, with that scene. Because, I watched it for the first time the other day, and I had no words. I was like, because I knew about the scene from watching the movie Badass. You know, more Mario Van Peebles. Basically, they talk about this scene, and it's a point, a little, kind of a minor point of contention. But he's like, you know, my son needs to grow up to be a man, so here we go. He has to do this scene. You know, I did stuff that I didn't like for my dad, and he has to do something for me. But when you see the movie, it's just you're like,
it's a little uncomfortable.
It's very uncomfortable, like extremely uncomfortable. And it lasts way longer than I thought it did. Like it had any right to, you know. But I feel like that was him kind of daring the audience, daring the people coming to see the movie, you know, I dare you to watch this, you know.
Yeah.
And it showed like that Melvin Van Peebles had some brass balls. Like this guy just didn't give a shit and was going to make a movie his own way. And I think that's why I love the movie Badass so much, is because it gives all the behind the scenes. And who knows, like, I don't know how, it's based off of Melvin Van Peebles' book, and but it's such a great way to explain how this movie came to be, and is very entertaining too.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize how
also for like a it's kind of a silly direct-to-video movie it is too.
Yeah.
Like it's not pretty, you know. It's like Showtime actually like helped fund it. Michael Mann. Put money behind it.
Well, because Michael Mann, his first date with his wife was going to see Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which would be I don't think my if I would have taken my wife to that movie, I don't think she would have stuck with me.
You don't know that.
I don't know that. No, but that's ballsy of Michael Mann. It worked out for him.
Yeah, yeah, and it is, you know, the Black Panther coming, like this was actually the. To be a member, required
viewing, yeah.
It was a required viewing to actually be a member of the Black Panther Party. And yes, the film was extremely successful. It was one of the most successful independent movies of that year. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it was that due to the Black Panthers, because they every one of their chapters went to the theater and helped fund. Or not help fund, they helped, you know, get this movie going. And, you know, the story is as long as, you know, as well as in Badass, Mario Van Peebles' movie. This movie opened only in two theaters, but it widely became, and it made, you know, like $5 million at the box office or something like that. And $5 million is huge in 1971. You know, that would be, you know, I can't calculate that, but obviously that's, you know, way, way up there, especially only costing basically, you know, over $100,000, I think is eventually what it turned out to be. Cause he had funding from other people. And then initially that Bill Cosby put in the rest for them to finish filming, because I mean, the crew was arrested at one point, you know, because black people had bazookas. They thought they were in the car or something, the camera equipment, you know, it just hit things here and there. But I just think it's so badass, you know, it really is, of just everything that kind of put together for this film over a 3-week period, you know, Earth, Wind and Fire doing the soundtrack. You know, Van Peebles writing, directing, you know, editing a good portion of the film, basically the brains behind the operation, and he pushed everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and he probably was an asshole on set most of the time, but you know, just pressing and pressing and pressing and just get it this done. You know, it reminds me of still independent film today, how people handle it.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about just doing what you love, getting out there, and then moving on to the next thing.
Yeah. Doing what you love and basically not making any money from it. I mean, hardly anything, you know. I mean, let's talk about Earth, Wind and Fire for a second, because he wrote them a $500 check to do the music for the film. And like that check, they never got paid for it. That check bounced. There's an interview with one of the members from Earth, Wind & Fire. I forget exactly who it is, but he goes, that check bounced all over the U.S., you know?
Yeah. And it's still to this day, they actually never paid him. Right. I think it became a joke at that point because, I mean, that kickstarted their career.
Yeah, they were fine.
And, you know, they made it big. They helped out with – you know, a huge thing. Cause I mean, they were in the same boat. They saw this film with, you know, a bad, kind of a bad black guy, you know, And that's the funny thing is with blaxploitation, which is another thing that became, is that most of these guys are criminals.
Yeah.
They're drug dealers, they're gangsters, they're not good people. Every once in a while, we'll get John Shaft, of course, is a detective, but he's still a hard ass, you know.
Yeah. Still doing his own way.
Yeah. But, you know, we have that, but they're the heroes. The anti-heroes. And I think that's something else, a big statement, which also blaxploitation got a lot of flack because then,
MPAA?
No, not the MPA.
NCAA's
yes.
College basketball.
No.
NAACP? NAACP.
You're fucking me up.
Right?
You're throwing letters.
AACP.
Yes.
Yeah, that. NAACP.
I couldn't get that out. I almost said the NBA.
The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
Okay. Well, anyways, they were against this, you know. They basically, Reverend Jesse Jackson, spoke out against it. And, you know, basically they almost felt like all the advancements they were doing were also going, you know, they were taking steps forward, but also taking steps back because now it's cool to deal drugs. Uh-huh. It's cool to, you know, be this poor at that time, African-American man. Being a drug dealer and, you know, doing this bad, shoving it to the man and doing all this. And then they were against it. And that's kind of where it all died off, you know, then because after Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, you know, then in 1971, we got a slew of blaxploitation movies.
Yeah.
You know, that's when it really, really kicked off. And, you know, and then they started going down little by little. And, you know, the films weren't as popular, but it also gave black people a voice, even though they might have not have been, you know, politically, you know, conscious at the time. Eventually they became politically conscious. So I think that's somewhat – they knew what they were doing. It was just – it's kind of like – kind of like independent horror in a way, you know, some of it's done right. We could consider it. Mm-hmm. And some of it's done incorrectly. And I think with certain blaxploitation films, it's like, well, let's just make this guy as mean as possible and kill as many white men as he can versus, you know, this guy was wronged. He's in trouble. Obviously, these crooked cops are against him. They're trying to get him, and he's trying to fight for, you know, his rights and everything like that. And I think that toll that it takes is, something completely different. I mean, we have Superfly, for example.
Yeah.
He's a coke dealer.
Dude, there's so much coke in that movie. Like, so much coke.
But, you know, even Superfly, we have Youngblood Priest – who is doing coke, who, you know, has what he has bitches all around him. You know, he's a badass. He doesn't let anybody fuck. You don't want to fuck with Priest.
No.
You know, he's doing coke. He's got the little cross on his chest, and that was what he uses to do his cocaine. But in a way, Superfly, Youngblood Priest, is trying to get out of that as well.
Right.
You know, he's trying to do this one last deal in order to retire. So in a way, he takes that, but he also twists it to the point of like, okay, I'm a bad guy, but I'm going to try to do better by getting out of this.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But then you have like Eddie, who's basically wants to keep doing this, who – realizes that this is the only way. You know, it's almost like Whitey put us in this situation in order just to do this. Like, this is all we can do. We can't do anything else.
Yeah.
And I think they tried to take that a little bit further in Superfly, but they just never achieved it because they were doing so much cocaine.
I was going to ask you, like, the amount of cocaine, like, they just treat, like, you know, you'll see a movie from the 70s or 80s and someone just, you know, grabs a cigarette, lights up a cigarette, right? And they're doing that all the time. Like, that's how much they're doing coke in this movie. And I'm like, are they really doing coke? Because I don't know. Like, I knew a guy back in college. I waited tables, and there was this guy that I knew. He was Guatemalan. He was adopted, but he was Guatemalan. And the dude, like, I knew him from church, funny enough. But then as he got older, he started getting into dealing drugs, and he was a friggin' badass. Like, he didn't want to be on his bad side. But the dude did coke. Like, I would always catch him doing coke at work, you know. And it's almost like he took lessons from Ron O'Neill. You know, the exact same movements, exact same. It was exactly the same. But it's like are they sexying this coke use up in this movie? Like, are there other movies where they do coke this much? Because I haven't seen coke done.
There's a lot of drugs in blaxploitation films.
Right, but this is so nonchalant. But, like, hey, you want some blow?
But the thing is this film takes cocaine as just kind of a side thing that they do for fun.
Right.
Also kind of the basis of the movie. But I don't know. I don't think it's abused, you know, because people were doing cocaine. I mean, at this time, people were doing cocaine.
Right.
It was a very, very popular drug. So I think it became like that. I mean, people weren't, you know, having cocaine parties and having I mean, I'm sure that was happening. But, you know, they just did it with ease, you know. Like, you have a good point. Like, people light up cigarettes. People were doing cocaine. They're not doing lines of cocaine off of tables in this movie and getting crazy and shooting people. You know, it was just something that's what he deals. He does it. You know, even though I think Eddie claims that he does a half a piece of dope every day, which I don't know what a half a piece is. but I imagine it's a lot, because if, you know, if you mention that, you do ever do cocaine, Sean?
No, never. Never.
I haven't either.
So pot only.
If anybody wants to let us know what a half a piece of dope is, I would like to know. Because if you've noticed, Youngblood Priest actually has a hard time describing things.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes, because he even has, you know, when they're at the restaurant and he's telling about the deal, he tells him, he gives him an example of how much coke he has, but then he says, how much money do you have? And he gestures his hands into a pile and he goes, this much. Not telling exactly, is that $1 bills, $100 bills?
Yeah.
Like, exactly how much money do you have? So I think he also has a problem, you know, describing things, probably because of all the coke he's done. But you know, this is another movie where, you know, he, you know, the cops want him to work for them. Yeah. He's trying to get out of it. He can only do this one last deal in order to get out. So it becomes kind of, he is the hero because he wants to do better.
Yeah.
He knows that this job is going to get him killed. So I think there is a statement. It's hidden in there. Not necessarily hidden, but it's there. I just think that people focus too much on him being, you know, a successful drug dealer. It's like, oh, man, look at all this stuff that Priest has. Look at his car. Yeah. He's such a badass. This is what it's like to be a coke dealer.
Color TV in every room.
Yeah, you know, that's the American dream. That's even said, you know, he's got an 8-track, you got 8-track player, color TV in every room. This is the American dream. But, you know, it's like Priest realizes that it's not. And I think that this movie is not focused enough on that in particular. Uh-huh. Because he's a drug dealer and he's a badass, that everybody sees it and it's like, oh, man, that would be awesome to be Priest. Which Priest knows it's not awesome to be him. Yeah,
right.
It got him where he wanted to be, but he is going to realize he's going to die.
Yeah.
You know, if he keeps up with this life. So I think there is a statement. I think that just people got it wrong. They wanted to pick that. That's all they saw was that, oh, Priest is a bad guy,
yeah.
Which, well, he's not.
Yeah, no,
know?
Exactly. That, well, that happens a lot too. Like the movie Scarface, you know, where people are. I knew a guy one time. He's like, man, can you imagine if you had all that coke that Al Pacino has right there in Scarface right in front of you, that'd be awesome. But if they totally misread the fact that, like, that movie is about the downfall of this drug dealer, you know, that isn't the life. It's not glorifying it at all, but people take certain things and in their minds they glorify it and they make that, oh, I want to get that level because that'd be so cool, you know.
Yeah,
the same thing happened in Superfly.
Right. I just don't think they notice that, and then that's kind of what bothers me a little bit about kind of the negative backlash that blaxploitation gets, because you're lumping black people again into that thing that they're bad. You know, we're white. we never had the conversations with our parents about how it's dangerous to go down to the fucking store at night because we might get shot by fucking white people or cops. We've never had that conversation as white people. There's a bunch of shit in there that we don't even know.
Right.
You know, and
which is why I think I never gave blaxploitation a chance, you know, especially when I was younger, because I was like, I couldn't identify. You know, this is something I just don't, you know, as a middle class white American, I just did not get, you know. But as I started studying more about the civil rights movement, started studying more about, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, things like that, and learning like what it was like, the life of a black American at that time was like, that's when I started getting the appreciation for blaxploitation as a subgenre. And it's kind of seeing it's more, because I think a lot of people think it's just kind of a goofy take on white film.
Oh, it's black, you know, people what I mean? Being black people. Right. And it's black movies, because the thing is that blaxploitation did its piece. It did what it was supposed to do, and it, you know, black people still made black, you know, black people made movies for black people. It still exists today.
Yeah.
But it's on a different note. It's not meaningful anymore. We have Tyler Perry who is making these fucking awful movies. Now, if black people like those movies, that's fine. There's nothing against that. But he's taking that, and you want to talk about going back. You know, like, how many movies do we see where we have the black guy as the hero, other than Denzel Washington movies?
Right.
You know, and it's just like, you know, that's disappeared. I mean, look how many stars we had in the 70s. We had Richard Roundtree. Mm-hmm. We had Fred Williamson. We had Jim Brown. We had Jim Kelly. You know, we had even our comedians like Richard Pryor, being a badass, you know. It the number goes on and on and on. I'm going to sit here and name every popular black actor. But
oh, please,
you know,
do, Brad, please.
Well, this is blaxploitation. But, you know, we just don't have that anymore. And it almost seems – you know, this is just what it seems to me. I'm not saying this is what it is. But before we had blaxploitation, before we had the badass – I'll just call them badass motherfuckers. Before we had the badass motherfuckers, we had, you know, oh, black people eating watermelon, white black people trying to be white. Mm-hmm. And we moved away from that. Now we're back at the same goddamn thing with these fucking Tyler Perry bullshit. You know? And true. It's like
– yeah, I see it. Yeah.
And you know, if black people like that – then that's it's fine, but it just like we went back.
Yeah, but see, I think Tyler Perry movies aren't for. I don't think they're for the mass black population. I could be wrong, but I feel like his movies are more for the black church going kind of Baptist. You know what I mean? Like evangelical communities, because there's always a.
Well, they do really well.
They do real well, and I think a lot of them are financed through a church of some sort. I think there's some.
Well, they're fucking financed through billionaire Tyler Perry.
But
now,
I mean, but like Tyler Perry as a person he's a smart businessman. You know, he knows where he's making his money.
He knows what he's doing.
You know, but I've seen him in some other things where I'm like, well, you know, he's actually not a bad actor. You know,
he's not doing anything wrong. It's just it just feels that we together as just, you know, culturally, we need to move to the direction of, kind of getting out of that, because it to me, that's just a personal feeling.
Yeah, well,
it's, you know, I'm not making any fucking statement saying that, you know, we shouldn't do this or anything. I just feel that I miss it. I miss that blaxploitation. I miss now when we get like all black cast, all black thing, we just get really awful gangster movies
or a Chris Rock movie.
You know, and I mean, people like to laugh. I mean, we have like Kevin Hart's out there now putting a movie like
in the theater
every Tuesday. But, you know, I mean, that's what people like. That's what people like. I just wish that we also had on the side.
Yeah.
We had kind of this resurrection of blaxploitation cinema.
But I think you're right about the time that blaxploitation came out, because of the 70s, it was ripe for you said yourself there was an anger there in the black community, a kind of a deep anger that they all kind of had, that kind of translated into these movies and into the people making these movies. They felt, even though it was just some action flick or whatever, they felt that they were doing something to empower the community. Whereas now, I don't think the culture is like that. I mean, still, I mean, I feel like we still have a long way to go, because, like, I mean, look, we're whitewashing Japanese anime movie adaptations. I mean, Scarlett Johansson starring in Ghost in the Shell, you know, and an all white cast, presumably for the Akira, you know, live action adaptation. The list goes on and on. I mean, it's been happening with Japanese properties like The Last Airbender, where they, you know, yeah, there's a mixed race cast, but they made the lead guy, who's supposed to be like a Japanese kid, a white kid, you know, and all the bad bad guys are like dark skin. Like, for some reason, like, this still like perpetuates in our culture, especially this American culture, and in Hollywood, where, like, for me, like, I don't see color, you know, like different people have different ethnic backgrounds and different social backgrounds, and that makes them who they are. You know, and that's great. I wish that would translate more into film. But yeah, we got a lot of films with all white actors, like all white directors. It's crazy, this melting pot of the country we're living in, that in mainstream, I'm talking mainstream Hollywood films, that there's not a more eclectic, you know, range of directors and actors and actresses. I mean, the Oscars this year are going to be another example of that, where, you know, opening weekend, they're on Martin Luther King Jr.'s, the weekend that leading up to his birthday, there's a movie about Martin Luther King Jr., Selma, right? And that got pushed under the rug. And then what is the number one movie? American Sniper.
You know? Snipper.
Snipper. American Snipper. American Sniper. And I'm not dogging either movie. I think both in their own right are probably good movies. I haven't seen either one. But it is telling, though, that on a weekend leading up to celebrating all the things that Martin Luther King Jr. did, you know, all just the foundation he laid for civil rights, hit them a movie based around that gets ignored, you know, where everyone wants to go see Bradley Cooper, you know, blow people's heads off, which is fine. You know,
do what they want to do.
It feels like
we're in a wrong place.
Yeah, like we're not. And I feel like all the groundwork that this blaxploitation laid, we still have a long ways to go. You know, and that's something that we can explore throughout the month.
Yeah, everything from, you know, how the 50s and 60s were, you know, with the civil rights movement, you know, coming, and in the 70s, even going from there. I mean, we have made it way, way past what we had, you know, between segregation and only black people can use this black bathroom and, you know, water fountain and the beatings on the street and everything like that. Of course, we moved way past that. We still have racism today. But, you know, like, I agree with you. I think that, you know, certain things need to be embraced. And this is something like blaxploitation. A good way to do it is get these movies back out there.
Yeah.
The same movies, you know, because I don't really think blaxploitation can come back. It's done, you know. It's you're not going to use the like thing of dead genre, but it is a dead genre because we have movies that emulate those things, you know. with Quentin Tarantino, like Jackie Brown and Pulp Fiction. There's a few things in those films that use blaxploitation elements. We have a movie in this 1972, The Legend of Nigger Charlie, who, you know, became a trilogy with Fred Williamson, which was The Soul of Nigger Charlie, and then eventually Boss Nigger. We have a Western trilogy of those films. And then we have in the 90s, we have Posse, who is also directed by Mario Van Peebles. Yeah. So, you know, they took those things from those movies, and there's also, you know, a few other blaxploitation Westerns. But we had, you know, they take things from there. I mean, we also have a slew of horror blaxploitation movies like Blackula and Blackenstein and, you know, Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde, you know, things like that, and J.D.'s Revenge. And then, you know, we have the very underappreciated, overlooked Bones that came out with Snoop Dogg. And there's a lot of shit in that movie that takes things from those past films and kind of sneaks them in.
Yeah.
You know, and I really dig that because I, at times, you know, it feels like it's coming back or they're trying to do something. But eventually, you know, one person made one movie that year of the blaxploitation, and then, you know, it's not even known anymore.
Yeah.
And it just kind of gets pushed under the rug. But, you know, these black actors, the black writers, directors, and even white directors started coming up. I mean, because Larry Cohen did Black Caesar. It was a huge success, you know, with Fred Williamson, where, yeah, you know, it's kind of a Scarface story.
Well, we talked to Graydon Clark.
Yeah, you know, he did the Warren Beatty,
yeah,
Black Shampoo, you know, and they took things, you know, like they took horror, they took Westerns, they took, you know, Kung Fu. You know, we have, you know, Jim Kelly and all these Kung Fu blaxploitation movies like Black Belt Jones and, you know, a few others.
Yeah.
So it was cool that they just didn't focus on action. They focused on every genre, even horror, even war. You know, of course, they had movies that were set in the hood, but they also had just a lot of things. They also gave women a voice.
Yeah,
we had black women as the lead, like Cleopatra Jones, TNT Jackson. You know, of course, Pam Grier fucking just knocked it out of the park, like with Coffee and, you know, Foxy Brown and Oshiba Baby and, you know, Friday Foster. You know, we just had the slew. They were giving everybody a chance,
mm-hmm,
you know, and now it's just gone.
Yeah.
You know, everything that they moved, and they also – just having all the, you know, Marvin Gaye and, you know, Curtis Mayfield and, you know, Isaac Hayes just doing these fucking phenomenal soundtracks. I mean, soundtracks that, you know, we want to listen to while we're not watching the movie.
Dude, and it's stuff, you know, we still, like, I'll still, yeah, put in some Curtis day, Mayfield, you know, man.
Yeah, just put it on and listen to it because there's a statement, there's, yeah, power, it's fun. You know, just that soundtrack, The Shaft alone,
yeah,
you know, that aerial shot of him coming out of the subway and, you know, it starts, and just kind of the funky lyrics too that are said in these, and they're writing music for the movie. They're not taking existing songs. They're doing these, you know, just killer soundtracks, basing the soundtrack on the film, and it's a perfect pair.
Yeah.
You know, we just don't get that anymore.
Yep.
I mean, we get that with movies today, of course, but I'm saying for blaxploitation,
right?
Like, it was giving everybody a chance, filmmakers, right, writers, actors, musicians, everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's good stuff.
So, I cool. know.
Well, we have a lot of stuff to talk about this month. I mean, we've just basically scratched the surface, I think. I know that next week we're going to be talking about kind of more modern influences of blaxploitation. I think that's what we're aiming for. We'll see. Hopefully, maybe we'll have Brian back on the show.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I miss Brian.
Hopefully. I'm keeping my fingers and toes crossed.
Yeah, I'm happy. Oh, one thing I did want to mention, Blu-ray announcements, is that Vinegar Syndrome, I guess, announced tonight.
No.
That they're actually releasing. There's a 1976 kind of blaxploitation film called The Mothers, M-U-T-H-E-R.
Oh, man.
The Mothers. That kind of – that has a lot of kind of elements, blaxploitation, you know, women in prison type deal. And it's not strict blaxploitation,
yeah.
But there's a lot of – a lot of elements in that film.
Cool.
Not too many popular people, but it's very underseen. You know, it's like martial arts and shit like that. So it's something to see. It's weird. So I wouldn't go on a limb and say it's like true blaxploitation, because I think by the time we were hitting the last of the 70s, you know, everything after about 76, we did have some blaxploitation movies here and there,
yeah,
but it was dying out.
It kind of died out by, what would you say, died out by
75.
Well,
yeah, because I mean late 70s, 70, yeah, 75 we had, you know, things like you know, we had Black Shampoo, you know, the trilogy for Bosnigger ended. We had, you know, Dolemite that came out, which mm-hmm. is kind of a parody of blaxploitation movies.
Okay,
which kind of like Black Dynamite is.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's kind of like how that name came about. We also have like Mandingo came out that time. So a lot of important films came out at that point. But I think after that, you know,
yeah, after that we were having you know, Brotherhood of Death is 1976.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they were still, but it almost like they became kind of mean at that yeah. point. Like. It's funny because you had, you know, kind of anger driven films, how the black community felt, what they felt like needed to be said, with all they could do it was through music and cinema. And then there was that backlash, and then when they were like, what the fuck? So they got even more angry and started making. You know, like the Brotherhood of Death is a great, great blaxploitation movies, but it's like basically dudes just fucking slaughtering the KKK.
Yeah.
Which is great. You know, that should happen in real life. But, you know, just elements like that, just really taking it to the next level. And I think they kind of at some point they kind of missed the point of blaxploitation. It became more of,
right.
You know, let's just do something crazy.
Yeah.
But I mean, I still like that, because I still like what they were doing, because we were getting films that white people were scared to make.
Yeah.
You know, some white people would not want to even touch a film with mostly an all black cast. But we did, you know, and that's kind of where the crossover comes in a little bit. You know, films like Vigilante, mm-hmm. Bill Lustig's Vigilante, which we have, you know, the lead is Robert Forster, a white man, but he also has Fred Williamson, who is a black man that's like, let's fucking kill these guys. We're going to band together. I'm going to get my brothers together, and we're going to go after these guys. This gang that's a mixed race of people, but there's black people there. You know, we also have The Exterminator, where the lead is, God, what's his name? Robert. Well, anyways, we have, you know, a white guy who his best friend is black and is murdered.
Right.
And he takes vengeance on basically the ghetto to come back and be vengeful. And, you know, so his friend doesn't die in vain. And just it's just crazy, because like there's a lot of elements in that. Now, those aren't blaxploitation movies, of course, but there's certain elements and certain things in there, especially a white guy killing for a black guy.
Yeah.
Like that's huge, you know, and yeah, Exterminator's a fun revenge movie. But it's a little bit more than that, which is fun, because in Exterminator 2, he kills Mario Van Peebles. But anyways, you know, it's fun because, you know, we have that fighting for each other. And, you know, that's something that, you know, I find special, too, because we're throwing in those mixed races and banding them together.
Yeah.
I mean, Lethal Weapon is huge. We have an old black man who takes in a psychotic white guy and, you know, they band together and become best friends for Christ's sake, you know, and inseparable. So I think all because of blaxploitation kind of kickstarted that. They wanted that. They wanted to make movies for white people and black people. And, you know, I think Exterminator is extremely important because we actually have somebody fighting. You know, even though the movie's made in the 80s and we're a lot past the 70s with civil rights.
It was only a few years past the 76. It was 1980.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so, you know, still at the,
right in there. Yeah. I mean, still racism is very, very popular at that time. It was slowly, you know, we were transitioning.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that movie is extremely, extremely important. And I really, really dig kind of the – I call it crossover just because those films use a lot of elements of blaxploitation even though the lead is white. But, you know, even fucking George Romero casting black people as the leads.
Yeah.
Even in Land of the Dead, the lead zombie's black. You know, we have Dwayne Jones in Night of the Living Dead. You know, we have what's his name? Henry? Is it Henry? The kind of the guy that steps up in Day of the Dead. You know, we have Ken Foray in Dawn of the Dead. Who is the leader? And you know, George Romero was doing something important in 1968.
Yeah.
He was giving the lead. He has the black man slap the white woman, you know, to get her under control. He takes control of the whole situation of, you know, with a bunch of white people. And I think that's super. By no means it's a blaxploitation movie, but, you know, it's important because I believe, you know, I want to believe that black people were sitting there, you know, that they were watching this movie and it's like, oh man, you know, like this is something. I mean, we're actually seeing ourselves on screen being portrayed as the hero.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many little elements like that that aren't blaxploitation that was leading up to blaxploitation.
Yeah. Well, it definitely transitioned black actors and actresses away from just being the supporting kind of, like you said, all those roles, like just the slave or whatever. It catapulted them into front and center, and Hollywood couldn't ignore them anymore. And that, you know, and that there's still echoes of that today. I think, you know, we complain about how things are in this society today, which, you know, if I feel like sometimes we are taking a few steps back, but yeah, blaxploitation did definitely laid the foundation to, you know, what we see in current movies today for sure, with everyone's for the most part on a level playing field. You don't see rampant racism in movies anymore, you know.
No.
I mean, that's not there. It's just we kind of want to see a little more color.
I mean, you know, yeah, exactly.
Throughout the year
we,
and all the movies we watch, that's all.
Yeah, we have, you know, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song came out in 1971, and the success of that, we have, you know, MGM or Warner Brothers, whoever was doing Shaft at the time, which, you know, is originally Shaft was written for a white cast, white people. And then they stepped in, they were like, oh shit, like, look at this movie cost $150,000 and it makes, you know, $5 million at the box office. Fucking let's take our white guy and make him a black detective.
Yeah, they had to. I'm looking at the release dates. They had to have done that quick with changing that over. Like that had to have been like a day. Like, all right, we're casting. We're all of a sudden going to cast black. You know,
I imagine really they did that quick. Because, I mean, the average, you know, time frame for kind of a big budget blockbuster at that time was, 30 to 45 days. So, I mean, Shaft probably was filmed. I don't know how many days that was filmed over. But, I mean, that's something that they can change quick. I mean, they changed the name. Maybe they didn't change the name, but they changed the race. And, you know, I mean, he just basically has to go through Harlem through neighborhoods of, you know, to find the missing daughter of a black mobster.
Yeah.
Which I think they just changed the races of everybody. I mean,
but the release date was only a few months. Like Sweetback was in April, Shaft was in July. They had to have, I don't know. They had to have heard while he, there's something there that I'm missing in the narrative here.
Maybe Melvin Van Peebles, because I get that I got that information from Melvin Van Peebles, and even, you know, the history of Shaft was originally white.
Yeah. So but what I imagine is they must have made the change earlier when he was probably still cutting the movie, but they probably – I don't know, man. I don't know.
Well, originally, I mean, we got to find out what that release date was. Was that a wider release? Because originally it opened up at two theaters and blew up.
Right. And it wasn't until later. Okay. Yeah. So
it wasn't until later until it actually got its official release.
So April 23rd is the New York City wide release. And then May was San Francisco. So those must be the wide releases. So
yeah, it must have released earlier
in the year.
I want to say that Sweetback was done in the 70s, like 1970.
Maybe.
No. That's why I never go. It's better than Wikipedia, probably. But it's known that Shaft was originally white. For a huge company that was in huge financial problems. It's funny because they still are. But
I know, huh? I was watching the documentary and I had to laugh.
Yeah, you know, what documentary?
The one on Badass, because they're talking about MGM. Is it MGM? Oh.
Yeah, I think MGM, Warner Brothers, was the people that were putting it together.
Or in the movie, one of the actors mentions MGM is having money problems in the movie. Okay,
every year it seems they are.
Yeah.
But, you know, they did this and it became – a huge, huge success because Shaft actually didn't cost that much, you know. And then it makes, you know, $15 million at the box office. You know, $15 million now is not a lot, but we're also talking about the 70s. Like I said, you know, $15 million is a lot more at that time. Yeah. But, you know, commercial success for these films, and then, you know, other black actors, other, you know, black writers, they were getting together and like, holy shit, this is my time. This movie that I have sitting here, this script, I can actually do it now because white people and black people are going to see, like, we're getting together and they're going to see this movie. Because, yes, okay, so what? Did all the chapters of, you know, the Black Panther takes about half of, you know, what Sweetback made. But what about Shaft?
Yeah.
You know, $13 million didn't come from all black people. No, that came from a mixed community. Everybody went to go see Shaft, and that's what's important. You know, yeah. Shaft might not be the greatest movie.
I think it was easier to digest, though. It's just an action flick. You know what I mean? Whereas Sweetback's Badass Song was was making a statement. It was an art film. It is an art film. It's totally an art film. It was there
point,
to make
you know?
A statement, whereas Shaft, not so much. Shaft more there to entertain.
Yeah, but also, you know, it's just awesome to see, you know, a black guy who is just relentless. And I just love, you know, Richard Roundtree's laugh in the film. He giggles, you know, at racism. You know, and there's just little things in the film, too, because at the very beginning, after he gets his chestnuts in New York, he calls for a cab and he calls for the cab. The cab comes up and stops for a second, and then it speeds off to go pick up a white guy. Shaft is having problems, but that's also like that little scene has such an impact just on me alone.
Yeah.
And I'm white, you know? And, cause like I said, there's things in life white people will never, ever, ever get because you're not black. It's just, no matter how hard you try, it's a cultural thing. It's just something, but that right there, like, you know, he turns around and he says, "Oh, you white motherfucker," or something like that, or, you know, but yeah, that's a huge problem though. You know, like Shaft, even though he's this awesome private detective who just kind of laughs off things, like he gets passed up by a cab because, you know, we have a tall black guy who has a jacket on, who is very intimidating looking. Oh, he might rob me, so I'm going to drive off. You know, it's just Gordon Parks put that scene in there for a reason. It's not for comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, politically aware is what that is. you know, conscious of what's going on and just throwing little things in there. I think that's a huge step, is doing that. Not doing something mean or, you know, saying, oh, white pigs and stuff like that. You know, he puts little subtle things in there, you know, and it's just like, this is what we deal with. This is what's going on. I really, really enjoy that. To an extent, I mean, I don't, like, you know, jack off to it because it's absolutely terrible.
You had to go there.
Yeah. Got to at least mention masturbation at least once. But, you know, with these directors doing little things like that, it really, really means a lot.
Yeah.
And I really want to see this genre come back in a big way. I want black people to rediscover it, because honestly, I think it's almost disappeared from that. You know, because I mean, I imagine there's still a lot of black people that, you know, love these films, and, you know, obviously MGM re-released them all. But I truly believe that this has disappeared. And it needs to come back. It needs to be embraced in every culture, every race needs to see these movies again.
Well, if anything, I think it's a huge important piece, you know, to Hollywood history. You know,
it's major.
That I don't think is taken as maybe not taken as seriously as it should be, but I think it should be taken seriously as a subgenre for sure, because it definitely kickstarted a movement. I think I was thinking we're not going to have a lot to talk about this month, but I think we have a lot to talk about.
We're just going over the history.
Yeah.
Until we get into the movies. I mean, alone. So I have to say that for anybody that's sitting back, because, you know, there's nothing wrong with it for sitting back and be like, oh, well, you know, I thought blaxploitation was just, you know, black movies for black people. Nah. Yes and no. It's way, way more than that. It's a statement, like Sean said. It's a movement. It's something very, very important. And my God, these movies are fucking fun. Yeah. They are so fun. Like Sean said in the beginning, these movies are just, I don't give a shit. You know, we're going to do what we want, and we are going to have Pam Grier blow the fucking head off. If anybody has ever seen Coffee, when she pulls that trigger on that double barrel and blows that guy's head off, like, his head comes apart. That's a great scene. But, you know, there's so many, like, just cool cars, you know, great outfits. It really, really quick and snippy dialogue. You know,
My favorite. Out of these movies, the dialogue is fantastic. Always fantastic.
You know, it's as soon as a white person says something, the black person doesn't put their head down in shame. No, they come back, you know, with something really, really snippy. Like, you know, just, you know, like Youngblood Priest in Superfly, when he, you know, he says, you pig, no one tells me what to do. You know, he just right off the bat to a cop, right to his face. You know, even though he might get the shit beat out of him, he still says it right to his face.
And he's ready, ready for it too. He's like, well, I might get my ass kicked right here, but you know what?
Yeah, okay. And it's a big stand. And just for anybody that's hasn't seen anything, you know, Cotton Comes to Harlem, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, Shaft, and Superfly. That's a great, great start.
Yep.
You know, because you're going to get history. You're going to get, because that's the great, because you have Cotton Comes to Harlem, which kind of kickstarts the idea that, oh, wow, we can put black actors as the main characters and succeed and have a successful movie. Then you have Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song that kickstarts a revolution. And then you have Shaft, which is a big, big budget movie that had a white guy in the original detective part switch to a black guy. And then you have a low budget Superfly directed by Gordon Parks Jr. Mm-hmm. By the way, who's the son of the guy that directed Shaft, directs Superfly, who has this killer soundtrack when they put, you know, Curtis Mayfield on it, which, I mean, Shaft has, you know, Isaac Hayes, who actually wanted the lead in Shaft, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They just didn't think he was right for it, so they had him do the soundtrack. But, You know, you have three movies that are so different, but are all that same, you know, kickstarting this huge, huge thing off. So that's a great quadruple feature if you're
I think so. I would also say if you can't track down those movies and if you can find Badass easily, that's
– Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, I forget what year. It was 2004 it came out. But so that's a great – kind of that's a great little history lesson into blaxploitation and the time, and that'll definitely get you hungry for some actual blaxploitation for sure.
Yeah, no, I say almost even starting that one out just to get you, and don't be afraid, because when it starts off, you know, like a Showtime made for TV movie, really, really bad credits, you know. And kind of a sloppy opening.
Yeah.
But once it gets kickstarted, once they actually start making the movie, like it really, really, it's hard hitting. Like Mario Van Peebles made a great, great little biopic.
Yeah.
About his dad.
I almost want to say it's his best movie. I don't know. Like
better than Posse? Better than Posse?
Yeah, man. Heck yeah, better than Posse. Posse's fun. Don't get me wrong. Posse's a lot of fun, but
better than New Jack City?
I don't know. Maybe not. But it's, you can tell his heart's in it, man. You could like,
no, yeah,
it's super good.
Yeah, no, the Badass is another great way to start if you want to go more modern. And it's also a lot of fun to watch Badass and then Sweet Sweet Badass Song. I don't suggest watching him Sweet Back first. I suggest watching Badass first.
There you
and
go.
Then jumping to Sweet Sweet Back, because
you'll get the context.
Yeah, you'll get the context and you'll appreciate it a little bit more, because you'll be able to see like, holy shit, that's how they did that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, holy crap, that's where all that came from. And, you know, because that's how I watched it more recent, because even though I grew up on these movies, but have watched these movies countless times. I mean, I've seen Superfly fucking, oh, jeez, probably like 10 times at least. I know that might not seem a lot, but that's a lot.
Yeah.
Superfly. I mean, it's just these movies never get old, because they still continue to make you smile, make you laugh, and you know you're taking a little bit of history. You don't even know it. I mean, we watch movies all the time. The movies were made money, forgotten about, but these movies wanted to change something. Yes, they were in it for the money, because obviously they're going to make money for it. But it was a little bit more than that. It was a voice. It was a revolution, and you know, just badass. There you go.
All right.
Badass.
Yes.
So,
you know, even if you misspell it, even if you put a bunch of A's and a bunch of S's in badass, Google will correct you. I found that out the other day.
That's good, though.
All right. Well, you know, I think we've laid the groundwork here. So we're going to be discussing blaxploitation throughout the rest of the month of February. Hope you guys are along for the ride. We're going to try to keep each show, you know, at different
topic. We're not going to be doing the same thing over.
And so, you know, I'm pretty excited about it. So stay tuned for the rest of the month. Let us know what you guys think. Go to thescreamcast.com. You can drop us a line via email through our contact page there, or we're on Twitter at @scream_cast. And we want to thank oneofus.net and also nerdly.co.uk for hosting the show.
Thank you.
And Wolfman of Mars for the music.
Thank you, Wolfman of Mars.
And I think that's going to do it for this week's show.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm
all
excited.
Right. We'll be talking to all of you next week. I'm really hoping Brian can join us, because I think he'll have a lot to offer to some of these discussions as well. So we are going to beg and plead that he joins us. All right,
modern blaxploitation is next, which I'm excited.
Yes, sir.
About.
Good stuff. All right, we will talk to all of you next week. Bye bye.
See ya.
Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. The party's just begun. Yeah.